Welcome to Making Therapy Better, the podcast that brings together some of the top minds in psychotherapy and related fields to talk about how we can achieve better mental health care for everyone. Making Therapy Better is hosted by Professor Bruce Wampolt, who has dedicated his career to understanding how therapy works and advocating evidence-based methods for improving outcomes. His guest today is Charles Raison, MD. Dr. Raison is a professor of psychiatry at University of Wisconsin-Madison, director of clinical and translational research for USONA Institute, and director of research on spiritual health for Emory Healthcare. His research has focused on the development and treatment of major depression and the physical and behavioral effects of compassion training. Recently, Dr. Raison has taken a prominent role in the emerging field of psychedelic medicine. He has received numerous awards, including being named one of the most influential researchers in the world by Web of Science. His most recent book is The New Mind-Body Science of Depression. Making Therapy Better is brought to you by CarePaths. CarePaths has been helping in-person and virtual therapy practices thrive for over 20 years with their complete web-based EHR and practice management platform. CarePaths provides free tools to help therapists as well as clients benefit from the power of measurement-based care to improve therapy outcomes. Visit carepaths.com to start your free trial, and clients can look for the free Making Therapy Better app, now available for iPhone and Android. And now, without further ado, episode 15 of Making Therapy Better, Depression and Psychedelic Therapy with Charles Raison, MD.
So Chuck, this is a real honor and opportunity for me to talk to you. It's nice. I've done the podcast, this is the second season, and finally I get to talk with someone from the University of Wisconsin. So even though we're kind of in different areas, this is wonderful to be able to do. And you bring a perspective on mental disorders and their treatment that I think is going to extend what we've discussed. Now, you're trained as a psychiatrist. Your work is very biological and neuroscience. But it brings a perspective that I think our audience, which are primarily practicing therapists, psychologists, counselors, social workers, as well as psychiatrists, to this idea of mental disorders, and we're going to focus, I think, mostly on depression, as being evolved adaptations, mind-body phenomena. So we'll get into some of the technicalities, but again, our audience are mainly practicing people. You know, we've been through quite an evolution in the treatment of depression with various medications. We're developing new psychotherapies all the time, but we haven't made too much progress in the actual treatment. So that's kind of where I'm coming from.
Yeah.
Let's start with this idea of depression as a mind-body phenomenon.
Yeah. Well, yeah, absolutely. And so this was my beef with one sort of iteration of the NI, the National Institute of Mental Health, you know, back around the turn of the millennium. The NIMH was so bullish that things like depression were brain disorders. They said that. I had a whole lecture series I would do back then disagreeing with that. I'd start with that and say, you know, that's just not true. You know, it's not, our brains don't float around in a vat. You know, they really are, they're at the very least, they're brain body disorders, right? And, you know, if you think about biologic psychiatry, one of its founding sort of impetuses was the realization that, especially back in those years, people with really bad depression had these cortisol abnormalities, right? They tended to be hypercortisolemic, and they tended to show resistance, especially at the glucocorticoid receptor, right? And they were not cutting people's heads open. You know, this was peripheral stuff, right? And so already early on, we knew that the folks with depression had peripheral manifestations. But, you know, where I got into the research game was really around 2000, 2001, just as this link between inflammation and depression was beginning to be apparent. And there was a drug whose many of you probably remember called interferon alpha. Nasty, nasty drug, right? It's a cytokine. It's an antiviral cytokine. It's made by the body. People had you know, built it, made it, and shown that it had some promise for cancer. But when combined with ribavirin, it turned out to have a lot of promise. In fact, it worked pretty well for hepatitis C, especially certain genotypes. But the problem was, as it had been for cancer, that lots of people that took it got really depressed. And the people who didn't get depressed got irritable and tired and kind of, you know, so everybody began to fall along a depressive spectrum. So this is interesting, right? Because the interferon molecule, the way it was pegylated, did not get into the brain very much, right? Mm. So it was really the first time this sort of suggestion that bodily processes not only might be a reflection of central nervous system things, but might be driving central nervous system things, right? Meaning that the body can make you depressed. And that seems to me to be pretty positive proof that thinking about depression is just a brain disorder. It's just biologically short-sighted, right? And of course, and that is on the most reductionistic level. Then when you pull consciousness into the act, I mean, certainly consciousness exists primarily in the brain, but it's sort of a different register of things, you know? And this is the thing we've been so most interested in the last few years, is trying to understand, you know, where does consciousness fit within the development of depression, but also within the treatment of depression? So, yes, I've always believed that the scientific, that you don't, it's not a woo-woo thing, that it's a scientific thing, yeah. That depression is, you know, this sort of mind-brain-body disorder. Those ideas have been co-opted in ways that can be kind of intellectually sloppy, but I think just from a terms of scientific rigor, it's pretty clear that all these processes are probably relevant, and probably relevant to different degrees in different people that are struggling with depression. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've interviewed a few guests about the idea of depression as being an evolved adaptation that adds to our fitness. So how does that tie in with this mind body? What's the fitness advantage of the depressed state?
Yes. Yes. Well, and I guess the first thing to say is that not everybody by any means that works in this space thinks that things like depression are adaptive things that have, that, you know, whatever the semi-inscrutable mix of genetic factors are that can be inherited that might set somebody up for an increased risk of depression. If we step back for a second and say, let's agree that some not trivial portion of the risk for depression can be passed on genetically in ways that would be subject to, you know, sort of standard evolution. If we grant ourselves that, then, you know, there's one school of thought that says, no, it's not adaptive. In fact, one school of thought is this sort of polygenic mutation balance idea that when a disease like depression is probably the final common pathway of a lot of genetic factors, that one of the ways people may get depressed is that there may be these sort of new kind of uprising of really purely deleterious sort of alleles that, you know, produce depression and are bad enough that the people that have it tend not to reproduce as well. And so that allele goes out of business, but another one pops up, right? So it's like, mm-hmm. Think about it like popcorn on a hot thing, you know, that the different popcorns are popping up, and at the level of the entire popcorn bag, you know, you keep seeing the same amount of popcorn. I do not personally believe that. I think the data suggests that those sorts of explanations are probably more relevant for things that are really obviously inimical to survival and reproduction, like very, very, very bad autism or perhaps early onset schizophrenia. So the challenge, of course, is if we grant that there must be depressive risk factors for depression, why do they exist? Depression seems to be so maladaptive in our modern world, and that's sort of the mystery that people have thought about, right? And you know, when we talk about depressive risk factors for depression, I think without thinking about it, we often just immediately go to between people differences, right? So you're happy all the time, you know, you can withstand any amount of stress. I fall apart like a cheap suit. We say, well, there must be some difference in our genetic structure that is partly driving that. But with the passage of time, I've gotten more interested in this idea or this question of why are we as a species so prone to depression? And why are we so prone to depression, not willy-nilly random, but when certain things happen to us, right? Because, you know, when people say, well, we don't know what causes depression, that's wrong. We know what causes depression. Loss, certain types of loss, loss of status, loss of relationship, all around the world, right? These are big, big drivers of depression. So why, you know, most of our genes have gone to fixation. So most of the genes that you and I have, we share. You know, it's only a portion of them that have a lot of, you know, sort of allelic variation. So why are we as a species? And why can we do animal studies that are depression-like? You know, why do we test our drugs on rodents? We separated from the rodent 60 million years ago, but there's little rodent equivalents to depression. You stress the rodent out, it looks like it's depressed and anxious. So there's some ancient thing going on where mammals, of which we are, you know, sort of related to, tend to manifest a depressive, anxious-like phenotype in response to danger, in response to adversity, especially when it's caught. Why? You know, so that's one level. Why on a species level? And then, of course, why is there this individual variation? And at the highest level, what I have suggested, and this is not at all original to me, is that, but it's a way I like to think about it, is that depression is really at core about handling our relationships with other entities. And I think the two major classes of entities that it is sort of adaptive for are conspecifics, so other humans, and then the world of the very small. So
say the second part again. So
the very small, so bugs, right? Because there's a lot of overlap in the sort of structure of our relationships with other people and our relationships with the microbial world. And, you know, other humans and microbes have been the primary sources of risk and benefit across human evolution. And most humans across almost all of history have either died from microbes or other humans, right? Because not many people may die of like Alzheimer's. And, you know, hunter-gatherers don't tend to get cardiac disease. They die of infection, or they die because somebody put a, you know, hatchet in their head. And so, you know, the suggestion is that depression evolved as a strategy for managing our relationships with other entities. Not a perfect strategy, but a strategy that was effective enough that it paid its way so that we see this variation in the tendency of individuals to adopt that strategy. So the idea of depression as evolving to help moderate or affect our relationship with other humans is an idea that's been around for a long time. A lot of people have written about it. There's some interesting data on it. A guy named Paul Andrews has written a lot about this. And there's various ideas for why it may be, including that it helps you stand down when you're in a conflictual situation with somebody that has more power. And there's some interesting data, it's a little older now, showing that, you know, if I'm fighting with my boss or I'm fighting, trying to win something, right? If I'm not winning, I tend to get depressed. If I give up, the depression tends to lift. Now, what's interesting, of course, it's not so good to give up, and you can get yourself in trouble giving up, but it speaks to this idea that it's a warning signal, right? We have written, not just us, but we were one of the early people to suggest that depression may have also been a way of helping us survive infection. And this was based on this sort of observation that inflammation, which evolved to fight infection, makes you depressed. Depression looks a lot like sickness. Depression on a group level has some symptoms that you wouldn't, that don't make much sense in trying to think about how it might be adaptive toward other humans, but do make sense in the context of infections. For example, as a group, people with depression have elevated body temperature. It's been shown over and over again. Just published a paper with Ashley Mason out in San Francisco, 20,000 people from around the world, showing that yes, indeed, depressed people have elevated body temperature. Well, fever, of course, is a sine qua non sign of real sickness. And fever evolved because it helps kill microbes. You know, it's not so clear why depression should be associated with that increased body temperature, but it fits if depression, in part at least, evolved out of sickness, right? And that fits with this larger idea that depression is essentially about driving us towards certain behavioral patterns that are adaptive enough in dealing with our relationships with other people and with the microbial world that they've persisted. The genetic, you know, underpinnings of that have been maintained in the human genome. That's the large idea. And then, of course, you know, it's interesting. Depression does certain things that are perhaps clues to why it might be adaptive. We've talked about one of them, which is surrender, right? And many of us have had this experience, I bet, where, you know, you're feeling badly about yourself because you're not measuring up in some way, or, you know, you feel like you're failing. If you've ever had the experience of something happening that you let that go, and you say, you know what, so I don't have to be perfect. Sue me. You know.
Yeah.
That's happened to me a couple of times in my life, and it's a massive antidepressant thing, right? It's when a therapy does that, that's one of the things that's sort of liberating. So surrender, I think, is one of the things that depression helps us do that can be adaptive and was probably adaptive across human evolution. I'm also very interested in the idea that sometimes depression helps us change, you know? And a lot of people have written about this, and this is very relevant for the psychedelic work we do. But, you know, there's some evidence that when people undergo a depression, it'll cause them. There's one paper in particular that I know of where if people have a depressive episode that they recover from, they tend to be less depressed going forward than people that never had the episode. Mm-hmm. And we all know that when depressions act as dark nights of the soul, they can sometimes cause people to move into patterns of behavior that then produce more well-being. You know, I can think of a lot of those examples. So change, surrender. And then, you know, in the context of infection, if you look at what depression does, it tends
Let's separate these two, because I think it's important, because you've got the cone specifics, our relationship with other humans. Then you have the microbe. Let's explore this, because I think it's really relevant to therapists to talk about an understanding of depression in the way you're discussing. So the surrender part, I get. But you also talked about loss. So how is depression adaptive in the presence of loss? So loss of relationship, death, and a rupture of longstanding relationship, this kind of thing.
Yeah, sure, of course. Well, and let me insert a caveat, which is that fever is adaptive, right? Mm-hmm. And so adaptive things are not always good, right? So a lot of modern medicine is actually trying to turn down adaptive responses that are too hot. You know, when you get heart failure, you know, your lungs fill with fluid and you can't breathe. You know, the reason your lungs fill with fluid is because your body's trying to do something adaptive. It because your heart's not working, it says, oh my God, we need more liquid to keep things moving. But the treatment is to reduce the liquid, right? Mm-hmm. If you're going to die of a high fever, the treatment is to give yourself a ibuprofen. So I want to be very clear. I don't want to valorize depression in ways that are both problematic and not helpful. So it's not the case that, you know, in any given instance, you want to let somebody die of the equivalent of fever, right? I mean, I think that goes without saying. But having said that, if we think about, and again, the other thing is that it's not always necessarily the most adaptive strategy, right? So what I'm not saying is that we live in the best of all possible worlds, or that evolutionary processes produce processes that are optimal. And we don't know if we live in a multiverse, but for sure we know that we can't see the other alternatives, right? So let's take a loss. Let's say that it's not the loss of a loved one, but that it's the loss of status, okay? That I get a lot of my sense of well-being from a job I have, and it's a prominent job, and I get a lot of respect for that. And then I do something that brings shame upon me. I lose the job. And, you know, this happens a lot in the modern world, right? And all of a sudden I go from hero to zero. Right. And I respond to that with depression. Well, one of the things that does, of course, is that the other thing I think that depression is it's like an early warning, not always early, but it's a warning signal. It's telling you that you're failing in some way. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And if we got time, we can go back and talk about from an evolutionary perspective what it's telling you you're failing at. But if we just take that, so, you know, the loss tell you what that's doing is it's signaling that you're failing, that something that you need to be who you are has fallen away, right? That you've fallen down a peg or two. It's like when they take the monkeys and block their serotonin and they fall down, you know, from top of the pack. So it's telling you a reality thing. You know, if you've had a lot of status from a high powered job that you've now been shamed out of, the reality of the situation is, yeah, your situation in the world is has changed, right? And the depression is accurately telling you that. And then that brings in, you know, the options to, do you accept that new lower position? Or do you then work to change? Do you try to get back? You know, traditionally in hunter-gatherer groups, all these things are sort of equivalent to ostracism, you know, being kicked out. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, being kicked out is death. So you make peace, you rebuild, you know, if you were a haughty guy, you're a woman, right? You know, that's one way, right? Much of the time, that's what works. Now, but there is another way, and it's much more like mania. And that is that you say, no, I reject, you know, I don't care if I'm in, you know, under an indictment for federal crime. there's the other strategy, which can also work, the high stakes strategy of winner takes all, right? So whatever we think of Donald Trump, if we look at him, he's either going to be the next president and potentially dictator of the United States, right? Or he's going to be, you know, either in jail or something, you know, he's defying this whole process we're talking about. Much of the time that leads to ruin. Some of the time it makes you Genghis Khan, right? It makes you whatever. That most of the people that are world leaders have a good deal of the opposite of what we're talking about. But for many of us, when you've made a mistake, when you've tripped up, when you've lost status, the smart thing to do is to pull back, reconsolidate, look at what's going on, make peace with the people that you were spurning before. You know, you see this all the time, right? And that's because generally, in many circumstances, humans need these sort of collaborative, cooperative, more, you know, depression is pulling you back down to an earlier time in human evolution where things are much more egalitarian, right? It's that move. It's fascinating to me, and I've not ever done any real work in bipolar mania around these evolutionary ideas, but it's a field that much could be done with, because clearly mania is very much the opposite behaviorally, right? Where, you know, you're going to do the opposite. You're going to, and, you know, of course, we know most cases of mania end up in disaster, right? You know, I often say life is like a game of 21. You know, if you get 20, you're doing pretty good. If you get 22, you're
fine. Yeah.
The depression's a protection against that a little bit.
But you're really talking about a social process here, that it's a opportunity to reappraise your social status. And your relationship. I don't want to put it all in status, but your relationship with others. Divorce is a good example.
Yes.
So how am I going to respond to the loss of this very important social relationship? And it's a chance to stop, think about it, strategize, not necessarily in a conscious, rational way, but it definitely takes you off the treadmill so that you can think about what you need to do to be socially engaged, which we know is important for mental health as well as physical health.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, I mean, but we know that I bet many of us could think about these really, really hard times in our life. You know, it's interesting. I went through a catastrophically difficult divorce. But I got lucky because, you know, I came out of that and it opened the door to the best period of my life but it also produced these sort of changes that allowed me to move into, you know, I grew up a little bit through it. Right. And so, you know, when it works, but I was depressed. Oh, I mean, it was really horrible, you know. when it works, that's what it does. But it does not always work, though. That's I really want to. You know, sometimes, you know, something like this happens and you start getting so depressed that, you know, you're going to just make things worse, right? And you need a little help to get up to a level where the lesson can be learned, the thinking can be done, right? So this is a really important point, is that, right, there's some sort of optimal level that probably varies from person to person, where you're going to benefit from that evolved depressive response, and then a level where it's going to cost you more than it's going to, you know, provide for you. And that's, I think these are the mysteries of treatment for me, right?
Well, yeah, very definitely. A few things. I mean, you're really making an advertisement for psychotherapy as a process to guide you through that very complicated. I mean, we're in a modern world. So the challenges for the depressed person are actually much greater than they were in the hunter-gatherer context.
Yes.
For instance. The second point is that, well, we have many kind of adaptive characteristics of humans that can go wrong. I mean, I'm reading kind of an interesting little book on why we get sick. You may know the book. Yeah. And it's interesting to see at a biological level, many of the important adaptive physiological aspects of the human can lead to disaster in particular circumstances.
Yes.
So let's talk just for a minute about the microbe level.
Yes.
Because I want to get into this idea of treatment, which obviously you've thought about, you've experienced, and we're going to get into this idea of psychedelics. But the microbe part, I think, is interesting. It's one that, as psychologists, I don't think about much because, you know, I'm interested in the social adaptive characteristics, and I don't think of mental disorders as a response to microbes. So,
yes. Well, certainly they are. You know, it's so interesting. The World Health Organization did a study, huge study, maybe 15 years ago now, looking at predictors of depression all around the world, tons of cultures. And number one was being sick. So we've known, you know, there's two royal roads into sickness. One are these sort of adversities we've been talking about, you know, stress, and the other sickness. And stress and sickness look a lot alike. So stress, psychological stress, activates inflammation. We've known that now for 20 years, 25 years. It produces the same chemicals, many of them, that you see when you get the flu. You know, it's quite interesting. And there are a subgroup of depressed people who have chronically elevated levels of inflammation, and their brain patterning is different than depressed people that don't have that. So we know that this is one of the roads in, right? And we did a study years ago where we said, okay, well, if that's the case, let's take a bunch of healthy depressed people and give them a very powerful anti-inflammatory agent, a thing called infliximab. It used to be advertised as Remicade. You know, it's a very specific blocker of one of these inflammatory cytokines. It did not work at all for depression in the whole group, but there was a subgroup that was inflamed before they started, and they got a benefit. It was very clear. And the infliximab does not get into the brain. So we turned in people that had too much inflammation in the body, when we turned it down, you know, we took the pressure off the brain. Because, you know, the reason inflammation, from an evolutionary perspective, I think, makes you sick is because it's telling you that you're about to die. And, you know, things that threaten your survival and reproduction are the things that, across evolutionary time, those are the things that still make us depressed. You know, the reason loss of status makes people so reliably depressed is because in every culture, status has been associated with reproductive success. The data on that are just striking, right? You know. So, you know, sickness, you know, there's an evolutionary thing there. It's a warning thing. Again, it's a warning that your evolutionary sort of status is at stake as an individual, is at threat. And we know, of course, now much more about what cytokines do to make you depressed. But it's interesting. They produce, you know, sickness looks a lot like depression. And it evolved, of course, as we said, to help you survive infection. You mount a fever that helps kill the microorganisms. You stop moving around. You stop pursuing other goals. You focus on the task at hand, which is diverting every available bit of energy from everywhere else into the immune system to sort of generate the massive cost of a massive immune response. So, you know, depression in the context of inflammation can really almost be seen as sort of chronic sickness. And because the symptoms overlap so profoundly, You know, you tend to get more suicidal, that sort of stuff with stress-based depression. But a lot of the other symptoms, we showed this years ago, a lot of the other symptoms are very similar. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's something to think about. And, you know, in people that have elevated levels of inflammation, it's likely a contributing factor to why they feel the way they do, you know, which is really interesting. I mean, this is what we learned from the interferon, right? We would take people that were not depressed. You're feeling fine. And we're going to start giving you that weekly injection. And within 2 weeks, you're going to be thinking about killing yourself. You're going to feel like you're terrible, horrible. You're crying. You feel all we've done is injected an immune system chemical into you. It's quite striking. Mm.
So two things before we move on. Interesting. We haven't talked about depression as a signal to others in the social world. And there's some people who have written about this, that we're really signaling that we need help from others.
Yes, I think that's also valid.
And the second point is that, and I've recently read a study of vampire bats, it's a natural quarantine, and this kind of fits with your microbe. We minimize our social interactions, particularly with non-kin cone-specific. Exactly. So it's a way, a natural way that it elicits quarantine.
Absolutely. There's a whole wonderful little field called behavioral immunology, which looks at this very question about how, you know, we are adapted to try to stay away from signals of infection, contagion. But yes, we tend to, this is a whole other thing, but it's just fascinating. Groups of people, the second largest driver of genetic differences between groups of humans, the first is interbreeding, but the second is the germs they've been exposed to across time. So we're more able to survive the germs we know than the germs we don't know. And, you know, you read travel, you know, it was very popular in the 1600s, 1700s to take the grand tour of Europe. But you read diaries from those days of the elites who would do this. And their fear was they'd die overseas because, you know, they were going to be exposed to germs that they didn't fully understand. They didn't have a germ theory, but they knew that there was this risk of death. Right. And so exactly, you know, it keeps you with people that you're going to have to be with anyway, who are likely to have more immunologic protection. It keeps you away from others. Because the problem is, if you're fighting a bacterial infection, that takes away your ability to fight a viral infection, vice versa. You do not want to be exposed to strangers' germs when you're sick. It's a bad. So that's another sort of one of the reasons we think that over time it's done this. Exactly.
Mm. Well, let's get into treatment. You know, the conversation we've had wouldn't lead directly to, let's give people hallucinogens, because that's going to be a viable treatment for depression. Nothing we've talked about has really said that would be an avenue we would pursue. So take us there. How do we get from what we've discussed so far to this idea, very promising idea, that hallucinogens are an effective treatment for depression. Yeah.
Okay, well, so what I'm not going to say is, but I'm about to say it, is that, you know, people are pursuing psychedelics or hallucinogens, I'll call them psychedelics, as anti-inflammatory agents. I don't know if you know this, but they appear to have anti-inflammatory properties. That I'm completely convinced that's not why they work for something like depression. But I think there is a tie with what we've been talking about. So, and there's a great paper by Robin Card Harris, who's such a leader in this field, kind of brilliant young guy, talking about the different types of serotonin receptors and the difference between what an SSRI like Prozac or Paxil does and what something like LSD or psilocybin that psychedelics do. They have different effects on the serotonin system. Psychedelics seem to produce, when they work, they seem to produce the same sort of changes that we've been talking about that depression causes when it is effective, which is a sudden stopping and a reevaluation of who you are in the world and what you're doing in the world, and then a recalibration that then produces both an outlook and a behavioral pattern that is more conducive to well-being. That really... Now, not everybody would agree with what I just said. There's a lot of people that very much are now trying to see them as simply reductive biologic agents that that are like super Prozac, right? But there's a lot of evidence to suggest what I'm talking about, which is that they're much more like psychotherapy. You know, we've been talking about psychotherapy or been kind of alluding around the edges of it. There's this saying, which I actually think has some merit in the psychedelic land, that a psychedelic, when it's done in a clinical setting, could be like a year of psychotherapy in an afternoon. And I think there's a significant amount of evidence to suggest that psychedelics are not super Prozac, that when they work, they're much more like super psychotherapy, that they have a lot of the same sort of, a lot of the patterns are similar. This is much of what our research group is actually studying. This is the domain that we're interested in, that we're working in. Because let's see what happens when people take a psychedelic and compare it to something like an SSRI. Okay, pick your SSRI, Celexa, Prozac, whatever. Here I go. I'm depressed. I'm depressed. I either think there's a reason why I'm depressed or I don't know. I'm just depressed, right? And I'm one of the lucky ones. I go see my doctor. He gives me, Lexapro or SSRI. I start taking it. I'm taking it. A week passes. 9 days pass. All of a sudden, I wake up one morning and I go, huh, I'm starting to feel better. You know, I don't know. I wow, it's sunny outside. And I don't know. Yeah, I've been so worried about how, you know, this and that, but I don't know, really sue me. I mean, how bad is it, you know? And then you continue to feel better, right? And then, you know, 4 or 5 weeks later, if it really works, you're like, wow, this is a dang miracle. Oh my God. You know, thank you, Dr. Wampold. Holy moly. And you go along and you feel better and you never know why. I've never met a single person that said, oh my God, Prozac made me realize that the dot. The only thing they realize is, wow, I felt really depressed and now I feel better. Right. Mm. It really does act like kind of a bottom-up treatment. Psychedelics are exactly the opposite. You come in, you're depressed. You get, you know, depending on the study, in some of our studies, you get up to 8 hours of meeting with two basically therapists, kind of Rogerian non-directive therapists. They meet with you. They tell you what to expect. You come into a pleasant room, you take the pill, you have two of these people, these facilitators or therapists, they're with you for 6 or 8 hours, sort of there to support you. And then you meet with them maybe 3 times on a weekly basis afterwards to just sort of work through whatever your psychedelic experience was like. And then your psychedelic experience, the doses we use in our studies are almost always mind-blowing, especially for people who have never taken a psychedelic, you know? I mean, these people have these mind-blowing experiences. And they tend not to be randomly mind-blowing. People tend to see stuff, and that does not correlate with their antidepressant effect. What seems to correlate with their antidepressant effect is are certain types of psychedelic experience while the drug is in the body for 6 or 8 hours. And one domain that has been repeatedly, not always, but almost always associated with outcomes is something that's called a mystical experience. And it boils down to this extremely positively valenced sense that, oh, I'm connected to something much larger that's very meaningful. There's a purpose in life. You know, that I see things as separate, but I'm part of a larger unified whole that's beautiful and meaningful. And life is sacred, and there's a sacred realm. Some people feel like God has touched them, you know, but that sort of sense, it's a mystical experience. It's what we think of as sort of that. The other thing that has very often predicted good outcomes is something that's much more difficult, much more like a dark night of the soul, which is it's called emotional breakthrough, which is psychedelics have this strange way of bringing whatever you're trying to avoid right in front of your face. So, you know, there's a lot of evidence showing that sort of, you know, behavioral avoidance, you know, this sort of psychological inflexibility. I can't face the things that are on a deeper level troubling me. Psychedelics take care of that very often. Boom, you're right in front of it. And often people didn't realize how much they were repressing it. And some people can't handle it. And that can lead to a very painful experience that can sometimes have bad effects. But when people are able to face it and cry and think about it and either accept it, like we were talking about, or say change, right? So in the early studies of people dying of cancer, almost to a person, they had these experiences where they realized, like, I am going to die of cancer. And cancer is part of life, and we all die, and I can't change it. I'm going to accept it. That's the surrender part. But then there's great stories in substance abuse where people go, why am I doing this to myself? I'm going to change. They're kind of released from it, right? when you face your demons, and it's very difficult, and people cry, and it's hard, but you feel like you break through, they very often then go to a mystical experience. But whether they do or not, that also predicts long-term significant reductions in depression and anxiety, right? Mm-hmm. So now all of a sudden, people the next day, the entire benefit of a psychedelic in most people is apparent within a day. The next morning, they're as undepressed mm-hmm. as they're ever going to be, which is really striking. And in our recent USONA Institute study, I mean, I'm talking about, I don't know if you do the MADRS, we had a 20-point drop. This is huge, right? And people will say, I don't feel depressed anymore because I realized that although my life is full of struggle, in ways I don't fully can't articulate, those struggles are meaningful in a profound way. And I'm so grateful to be here on this planet. And or, you know, I realized that my drinking is destroying my life. And I've realized I'm going to stop. I have children. I don't want to do this anymore, right? You know, something like this, right? So it's more like hitting bottom with AA. It's more like having a religious experience that people have that's transformative. And then people go off and about their lives. And sometimes the benefits will last for years. Sometimes the benefits will last for months. Sometimes the benefits will last for a month. Sometimes people don't get a benefit. You know, it's nothing perfect, right? But it's very different. And in that way, it's like there's in all ways, there's a sort of sense of insight that is suddenly manifested. And so people will tell you why they're not depressed anymore in a way that's very different than the sort of bottom-up SSRI kind of way.
So this is interesting because this idea, I mean, you're talking about two effects, the mystical effect and the insight, acceptance, experience.
Yeah.
So let's focus on the second one because I want to explore how the psychedelic experience and psychotherapy are similar and maybe adjunctive. So you talked about the therapist in these trials as being kind of Rogerian. They're there to support you. They understanding, there's some understanding of the effects of psychedelics, obviously, but there's a kind of, it's not so much a guide as it is a companion, the way you expressed it. Mm-hmm. I could also see a role for a therapist who's much more active. Mm-hmm. And what comes to mind for me is a psychodynamic therapist who, prior to the psychedelics, would explore kind of the defenses, the relationship with childhood figures, probably some kind of trauma, relational trauma. We know that the preponderance of, or the prevalence of these kinds of experience in depressed people very high. So that the framework is set for understanding that insight. And then that same psychodynamic therapist in the debriefing period talking about how that insight really is related to your life to this point. Or is that just not necessary with psychedelics?
Oh, no. That's how it all started, right? So back in the 50s, when all this stuff started up, there were these two approaches. One was exactly what you're talking about. Lower doses of psychedelics done more than once in the context of a psychoanalysis, basically, you know? And this was called the psychedelic approach. And the idea was, that they would kind of bump you into this sort of embodied sense of you know, what the analysis is trying to, you know, pull out and resolve, right? That is, there's a huge interest in that. The other approach, actually, the sort of psycholytic approach, which was initially started by a guy named Humphrey Osmond, in many ways, up in Saskatchewan, interestingly enough, grew out of alcoholism. So he was working with alcoholics, and they recognized that when people got the DTs, you know, the right, that they would go psychotic and they would often quit drinking afterwards. And he said, well, psychedelics make you psychotic. Why don't we give people psychedelics? And it worked. You know, it was not known until more recently that Bill W., one of the two founders of AA, the only thing that finally got him off drinking was LSD. He had a transformative LSD. So this was this, let's give them a high dose, blow their minds. So that's what's been picked up in the drug development space, right? So we're all working in that psycholytic idea of a high dose, blow your mind, you know, maybe one treatment or a couple of treatments, you know. But that's only one of the ways that these things were historically used. I think the idea being that, of course, nobody does psychoanalysis much anymore, and not that many people get psychodynamic therapy. So especially in the commercial space, you know, people want a high dose, they want a one and done, or they want you to have to take a pill every 3 months, whether you know, that kind of thing. But no, you're right. And it's not just psychodynamic strategies that are of interest. There's a real interest in ACT, you know, acceptance commitment therapy. So Jeff Guss and people at Yale have put out a manual that's available online, you know, sort of how to use psychedelics within that context, you know, which is a more directive, it's more normative, you know. You know, an ACT approach would be, look at how the psychedelics show that your thoughts are just thoughts. You know, as opposed to many people, the thoughts they have during a psychedelic are very real to them. And that's what's transformative, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's very, very interesting. No, this is all things waiting to be studied. Nobody has yet studied this.
Mm-hmm. Well, this raises, we need to talk about where the field is going, who's going to be the clinicians that administer such treatments, what are the requirements for such treatment, and who's going to make money from this? Because particularly in the United States, much of our health system's driven by profit. So what are your thoughts about, I mean, we got professional issues and business issues that I think are really important, because if this is a treatment that's going to help, you know, the chronic treatment-resistant patient, we want to make sure it's done clinically in an optimal way. But we have a lot of pressures from a healthcare system and for entrepreneurial entities.
No kidding. Yeah. Well, man, well, this is that we could talk about this. This is really interesting. All right. Let's talk about clinicians first. We don't know. That's the first caveat, right? But the FDA, well, in the beginning, they were really rigid, but they've eased up and they seem to be headed toward the idea that if you're a licensed clinician with mental health experience that's got some kind of, you know, you're going to be able to be a psychedelic therapist or facilitator. You'd be one of the people in the rooms and one of the people doing the integration afterwards. A prescriber is going to have to write the script for the thing. There's going to be what's called a REMS, a risk evaluation mitigation strategy, almost certainly. So there'll be some training involved, and you know, you're not going to go down to Walgreens and get this stuff. MDMA, which is ecstasy on the street, is pretty close, we think, to getting FDA approval for PTSD, combined with 12 weeks of psychotherapy. It's explicitly a combined treatment. How the FDA handles that later in the year is going to provide a lot of insight. So that we think that it's going to be licensed clinicians. There's going to be some specialized training, probably not a lot. And then a prescriber would have to write the pill. Now, financially, this is a huge issue. And it's one of the most interesting pragmatic things in this space. And it's evolving so rapidly. It's crazy. In 2015, when I came into this space, there were two nonprofits that were working to try to develop these kind of things for the FDA. One was what's called MAPS, Multidisciplinary Association of Psychedelic Studies. The other was USONA here in Madison, Wisconsin, where I took on the role of Director of Clinical Translational Research. We thought that psychedelics were a nonprofit, good for society, public service, post office kind of work, right? You know?
Yeah.
But once it became clear that they had this profound apparent effect, and once it became clear that the FDA was going to be very likely to want to approve them for a large-scale disorder like depression or something like that, there was this massive commercial gold rush. Several billions of dollars flowed into this space from two nonprofits. I think probably the max was maybe 80 or 90 commercial entities were in this space. You know, gazillions of dollars were in this space. It's gotten very competitive. It's gotten very entrepreneurial, nasty patents. There's going to be lawsuits, probably. You know, everybody's, you know, because you got to have intellectual property to make money. How do you have intellectual property on something like psilocybin that was, you know, developed by Sandoz back in the 50s? Well, people, there are companies that have claimed patents on the kind of couch that you lay on, literally, right? It's ugly and it's crazy, right? The height was probably 2-3 years ago. Many of these companies have subsequently gone out of business because, you know, people thought this was going to cure all mental illnesses forever. When the first bigger FDA type studies came out, these agents worked, but they didn't work perfectly. And people that are chronically depressed tend to lose the effect over 2 or 3 months, right? And there was a bit of a safety signal. You know, a couple of people made suicide attempts because they hadn't responded to the psychedelic, it appears. So all of a sudden, the splash of cold water, foosh, on the face. This is so typical for the United States. You know, oh, this is the answer to all our problems. Oh, meditation, that's going to solve. Oh, it didn't. Oh, well, forget it. You know, so there's been now this sort of hype cycle is going on. There's still plenty of entities in this space. There are still big commercial entities that intend to charge a tremendous amount for every pill in the thousands and thousands of dollars. And to have patents will keep other people from being able to do this, right? There's a company that's patented the use of a psychedelic with SSRIs, where if they have their way, you're not going to be able to use a certain SSRI. If you're on an SSRI, you can't take psilocybin unless you buy their product, right? So, I mean, it's like that, right? You know, it's because it's do or die for those companies, you know? And we don't know. Well, the challenge is that it's not so easy to figure out how this is going to be monetized the way it's currently being construed. You know, if you have to meet with two kind of facilitators or therapists for a couple hours and then spend 8 hours with them on a dosing day and then meet with them afterwards, you're talking 20,000, maybe something like that, 25, you know, and then if you're going to charge 10,000-20,000 for the pill, you know, so let's say that let's be cheap. Let's say the treatment costs 20,000 bucks. Now, if that fixes you forever and you've got treatment resistant depression, that's a trade. But what if you need that 3-4 times a year to keep afloat? Right? You can see where this is going, right? So it's not so clear. And then there's a very important sort of spanner in the works, which is that states are not waiting around for the FDA. They are increasingly legalizing the use of psilocybin and MDMA. So Colorado, for example, is very close to allowing people who are doctors or nurses or you don't even have to be, but you can be you, me. We can go get a little bit of training and then we can treat depression in Colorado with natural mushrooms. I mean, you can come into my office. You would be able to if I had an office in Colorado, and I could do exactly what we would do on FDA approval. You're just going to take some mushrooms instead of a pill. And, you know, that's going to cost you $3,000-$4,000 probably, but it ain't going to cost you $20,000-$30,000, right? And so, you know, and Oregon is so complex, but it's also available there. And, you know, they got thousands of people on their waiting lists. But Colorado, the way they're setting it up, it's like Katie bar the door. You know, you're depressed. You got a few thousand bucks to spare. You want to go do it in a sunny place. Denver is going to be your answer, man. You know, and so that, and I, you know, I have insider knowledge that Utah is looking at these things. It's not all the blue states, right? You know, so there's going to be this movement where an increasing number of states, unless the federal government cracks down on it, it's just going to be legalized. You know, and not like cannabis where you can buy it down at the no, I mean, I'm saying that you're going to be able to go to your doctor and get a treatment for a mental condition. You know, it may just skirt the FDA. So go figure that even adds
complexity. Fascinating. I mean, I don't understand the economics of it because the actual formulation of these substances, as you said, have been known since 50s, 60s. How can you charge so much for the pill? But two things concern me. One is the protocol for this. We need some research about what's the optimal way to do this. I mean, it is a drug, but it's given in a social context. We need to understand how to optimize the effect and what training and what protocols are needed. So that's point number one. Point number two is, I don't have 20,000. Why don't I just go buy these drugs on the street and do the same thing? I mean, if I were debilitated, unemployed by chronic depression, and I was at my wit's end,
yes,
I would go buy the stuff on the street.
Yes, yes. And we and others have done large survey studies suggesting that on average, it's more likely to help you than hurt you. Oh, we've published big studies of people that have done just what you talked about, and most of them say it really helped me. So I will tell you that a gentleman that I greatly admire, who was in many ways the father of this sort of renaissance, I asked him once, I said, you know, why did you decide to study psilocybin? You can grow it in your basement. You know, I mean, wait. And he said, exactly. He said, because back in the day, I saw that pharma might come into this and it might cost $10,000 a pill. And I wanted a safety hatch. You know, he very much believes that psychedelics are useful in a more broad sense. And many people believe that. And so baked into the very beginning of all this was that safety hatch. And that's exactly what's going to happen. It's happening right now. It's happening all over the country. It's really happening in places like Colorado, where it's legal now. For, you know, people can't sell mushrooms to each other, but you can give mushrooms. There's already plenty of places in places like Denver where you can get a bag of mushrooms and somebody will come sit with you. They'll, you know, and they'll charge you, but you know, you can do it with a buddy. This is going to escape. You know, this is like the Russian boars, you know, that they're all over the country now because they were on a ranch in the Carolinas in the 20s. They dug under the fence. Psychedelics are going to dig under the fence. They are digging under. They've dug under the fence. This is now beyond that, for good or ill. And again, fortunately, the data suggests that many people benefit, but there's going to be casualties. There's going to be adverse events. One of the hats I wear is down at the Emory University at the Center for Psychedelics and Spirituality. This is one of our commitments, is to understand these sorts of adverse events. Now, in terms of optimizing the use of these things, you know, that's interesting. The FDA does not require that. They do require optimizing the dose, and that's interesting, right? Because they want to approve not the most effective dose, but the lowest dose that's effective, usually, right? These agents are going to, if they're approved, they're going to be approved way before they're optimized, because all you got to do is show it works. And, you know, in regards to the therapy, it's very interesting. There is a company that I greatly admire. I don't agree with them, but I admire them and I know them quite well personally, called MindMed. And they have taken the therapy out of it most explicitly. You know, they send patients a video beforehand. Then they these are people with generalized anxiety disorder. They're using LSD in this case, and there's no formal therapy at all afterwards. It's just a drug, you know.
What the FDA approves is drugs.
And this is why they're so smart. Because the FDA is tearing its hair out. We don't approve psychotherapy. What are we doing here? You know, so, you know, my buddies at MindMed say, exactly, you know, therapy is going to make it way better. But we're a drug company, you know. We're just going to show that it works. We're going to do it in a safe environment. And it doesn't have to work optimally. It just has to work. And if it works, then, you know, Dr. Wampold, you're going to figure out, you know, how to optimize it. You know, I mean, it's a very logical argument. So that's also a foot in the field.
Yeah. Well, I have to say, you know, this discussion and my reading about this previously, both is tremendously leads to optimism. This is exciting.
Yeah,
but it's
cool.
Also very scary to think about how this might be misused by the professions as well as the people seeking treatment.
Yes.
I mean, the potential for abuse is great. The potential for adverse effects is great. But that's balanced by the opportunities. You said you've done these surveys of people doing it in unsupervised situations, and it's more likely they benefit than they have an adverse effect.
Yes.
Yet
there are adverse effects. Oh, yes. Yeah. So, you know, one good piece of news is that they don't appear to be, psychedelics do not appear to be physiologically addictive. So you can use them incorrectly, but people don't tend to get strung out of them that way. The adverse events are the things that I think we're really going to have to watch, because consistently about 3-7% of people who do it in an unsupervised setting will say, I had a prolonged difficulty because of that psychedelic experience. Now, some percentage of them will say, but I also benefited. It's very strange, right?
Yeah.
But there's no doubt that these agents, Yeah. You know, and the adverse events are almost always psychological. You know, mm-hmm. If your mind is blowing, that can be great or it could be horrible.
Yeah.
And there's a fine line between the two, right? And so that seems to be the big risk is, you know, that people are taken into these sort of other realms or they're, you know, if you're not ready to face stuff in your life and it's put right in front of your face, that can screw you up. It's too much too soon.
Thank you for saying that so succinctly. I think, I mean, that's my kind of feeling at this point. You really need somebody trained and to have the necessary work before and after use these substances.
Yeah. And that, you know, that, of course, both in our research work here at UW, but at USONA Institute, I mean, that is the commitment, right? Is that these are serious molecules that need to be done in a protected, responsible, clinically informed way. That of course, there'll still be risks, but that's going to maximize your benefits and make them as safe as possible. It's a really important point.
Well, this is a good place to end the conversation because I think we got to exactly where I hope we would discuss. This has been a fascinating conversation all the way from kind of the origins of depression evolutionary to modern treatments. So we covered the ground.
It was a lot. It was great, though.
Yeah. So fascinating. I look forward to it. We're both here in Madison, so we're going to have to get together, I think.
Yeah, we should get together sometime. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It was great. So thank you. It was an honor to be on.
It's an honor to have you, Chuck. Thank you very much.
Sure.
Thanks for listening. Making Therapy Better is brought to you by CarePaths. CarePaths offers a complete behavioral health EHR and practice management software solution, including claims, billing, clinical notes and documents, scheduling, and teletherapy, all for one simple and affordable monthly price. CarePaths EHR is HIPAA compliant and ONC certified, and can also support electronic prescribing for an additional fee. With CarePaths Connect, clinicians can enroll their clients in automated measurement-based care and create a digital front door for their practice. If you're just starting your practice or are dissatisfied with your current EHR, go to carepaths.com to start your free trial today. If you are currently in therapy and want to know how to get the most out of your treatment, check out the free Making Therapy Better app and visit makingtherapybetter.com.